Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in award-winning hypnotherapist, Harley Street certified practitioner, author, app developer, and podcaster himself, Mr. Ivan Rose. Ivan, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here today.
I'm really happy to have you. So I understand that you've helped thousands of people throughout the years in varying ways. So I kind of want to press rewind if we can. If you can remember the time in your life where this proclivity to help others and start to have a deeper understanding about how we work and how we work better comes into your life.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so actually it was about 15 years ago. I think I had an epiphany. I was in Sarasota, had a girlfriend here in Sarasota, and it all went a bit wrong. My life changed drastically. And I kind of undid everything I'd worked really hard for 15 years. And I ended up taking a job back in the UK. And I was so on my knees. Everything had gone so wrong for me. I found myself as a roommate in a place called Ipswich, working for someone else. And before I had my own business, it was very successful. As I said, it went flat on me. And so I decided to go and see a hypnotherapist to help me, thinking I'm dysfunctional, right? How can I have my life go wrong like this? So I went along and they ran hypnotherapy courses. So I decided to do it to help myself. And I did that for 2 years. And it really did sort me out, really helped me. And I studied hard and worked on the side as well. And then I went back to my hometown. And I never intended to do this for a living, but I was always wanted to make money in business,
right?
And I went to I lived in a shack, really, because I had to rent my house out. I had some other issues going on at the time. I started meditating a lot, and something happened, and I just realized that it's time to stop chasing money in business, and it's time to focus on others. And I realized that I needed to help others. And so I started studying different therapies. I started studying havening, thought-filled therapy. I studied hypnoanalysis. I studied all kinds of different therapies. And the stage was set for me. And I started writing comedy. And I started, I worked in a practice. So I had to study hypnoanalysis, which is trauma.
Yeah.
And so I went to see someone, because that's part of the deal. You had to go and see someone and do it yourself.
Okay.
And then he said to me, to work in a practice. I know someone that would be interested in you to work in the practice. So off I went to see them. They gave me a job, and I worked there for about a year. And then one day, a child comes in to see me. And I'm thinking, okay, well, the child runs out mid-session. And the parent is freaking out. The parent's saying to me, oh, my God, the child's run away. What are you going to do? I said, leave it with me. Where's your car parked? She said, no. He'd be on the streets. He's only 11 years old.
Right.
And I said, okay, don't worry. I'll go to the car park. I guarantee he's by your car. So off he went. Freezing cold day. There he was by the car. He started running away from me. And I said, look, I'm not here to say anything to you. Just to let you know, your mum's still inside. We're still talking. You're welcome to come back in. But if you want to wait here, she'd be a while. And off I went and spoke with her. Anyway, cut a long story short, I had a great result with him. And then they started sending the children to me. And I realized that I just had, because I'd been through so much myself as a child, you know, I was a runaway child. I was in children's homes as a child from running away. And I lived on the streets from, you know, for a couple of years sort of, and sofa surfing as it were, trying to stay wherever I could. So I'd had a lot of experience of hardship as a child. And I realized I had a bit of a gift to help children. I kind of understood what was going on with them. And from there, then I set up practice at home. Then I had an autistic child come to me. And I got a really good result with him. And the mother was really overwhelmed with what I was able to do,
I'm sure.
And so I then decided to write a story. Like, I started writing small books. So I started writing books to help youngsters. So I had one, you know, No One's Better Than Me, Happiness is a Boomerang. And there's about, I did a range of five of them. And And so I did those and I started to use those in the sessions and started to work really, really well. And then I just carried on with the practice. The practice came home with me. So I started working from home. And I realized that when I don't know what to do, I can just feel what to do, like something happens. And I always manage to figure out what to do. So then during COVID, I decided to write another book called Hello Future, Goodbye Past. Because it's not about what you've been through and what happens to you. It's about how you manage it, how you deal with it. Are you prepared to get help for it? Are you prepared to do something about it? You know, we've all got gifts, traits, and talents, and it's how we work them. You know, we can look at ourselves in a negative light, or we can see things positive.
Right.
And I always think, you know, if you look back too far, you're going to get a crick in the neck. You're going to look forward, right?
Right.
And you need to learn from your mistakes. So consequently, I wrote these books, worked in a practice, worked for myself at home, which I still do now. And then I decided that I could help people on a bigger scale. And so I developed this app, and it's been 3 years in the making. And it's literally in for submission right now into the App Store and Google Play. And I'm really excited about it.
Very cool. So let me ask you this. What was the time period like? What were you doing in life prior to this? 15 years ago, you had a moment, the girlfriend. What kind of business were you in? What were you doing? Was this a hard left in life?
You know, I fell into real estate. A friend of mine had was the manager of a company, and he offered me a job. And at the time, this is probably about 30 years ago, I guess. And so I did that for a while, and it was going well. It was a bit of a struggle to begin with. Anyway, I set up my own rental company, property rental company. And so I had that for 15 years. I managed 600 properties.
Good grief.
I did very well at it, but it was very confrontational. And I could have made a lot more if I was a lot harder, a lot tougher. But I don't like, you know, I believe in kindness and helping others. So I always have done. Because when I was previous to that, I was a Samaritan's counselor in the UK. So I've always been heading towards this destination, I guess, but never realized it.
I'm unfamiliar. What is a Samaritan counselor?
So Samaritans are people, it's a counseling service on the phone where people who are suicidal, people who are very distressed could phone up and have someone to talk to.
Okay.
So it's a big thing in England. I would have thought this here too. There's another one called Mind. And I, in my 20s, I decided to go and do that. It was a voluntary thing I did. And it's just moved me forward. So when I worked in the real estate business, it wasn't something I wanted to do. It was something that worked well.
Right.
And it wasn't pleasant. And then I opened up another business. And that was my downfall. And so I decided to do something that I liked, or something that other people liked. So actually I was here in Sarasota, and I went to a restaurant on 41, and the owner, I was chatting to the owner, and I said, you know, I wouldn't mind selling food. I wouldn't mind selling burgers or something, or doing some type of noodles or, you know. He said, no, you should do a cupcake. Cupcake could be a bigger thing. He's Welsh, no, he's Italian.
Yep.
Anyway, so I thought that's a great idea. And I went back to Southampton and at home, and I saw Minnie's Cookies, and I saw Dunkin' Donuts. And I thought, cupcakes, you know, that's going to be fashionable.
Right.
So there I decided to do it. So I opened a store in a shopping mall. I opened a bakery. And then I went on to open two more stores. Well, one of the stores didn't work too well. And I realized that, you know, if you want to open up a restaurant, you best be a chef, in my opinion, right? If you're going to open up a bakery, you need to be a baker.
That was what I was going to ask you. Yeah. Do you have any baking background? No. This was just totally curveball.
No, I learned a bit of bakery as a child with my mother, but that was about it.
Yeah. You know?
I just had a love for it, you know, just thought I'd like it. But anyway, so there I went to do it. And, you know, it was just a hard slog all the way. The shops were open 7 days a week. And one of the stores was in a place called Bristol. And it really didn't work out too well. It rained every day, and it wasn't in the mold. It was on the outside. And so there I am working 7 days a week, not wanting to do it or be there, absolutely stressed out, and closed one of the stores. Well, then I was working and not work. It wasn't making me any money, you know, so I was starting to struggle. And I decided I sold the other business and invested into this business. So then the shopping mall, I closed one of them. And then the shopping mall got pretty ruthless with me and started to give me a hard time on the other ones. And they would send a bailiff around to assess it for in case I was going to close all of them. So I decided to pull the plug on it. And then they decided to sue me for 10 years rent. So it was a big deal. And it really took me from having everything to having nothing. Literally, it really was a slog. And I thought to myself, gosh, it's just one struggle after another, you know.
Right.
And then I let the universe take over, I guess.
Love that.
And when I went to a place called Ipswich, I was very fortunate, actually, because I had a good friend here who is still my good friend who introduced me to someone who gave me a job in Ipswich. But when I worked there, it was an import-export company.
Really?
And when I worked there, you know, he was shouting at me. It was a difficult situation. I find myself in a room in a senior house, and I've gone from having a, you know, really nice lifestyle to, you know, to really not knowing what to do next. So, and now I just, as I said, trust in the universe, and it's all been going the right way.
So is that partly how you ended up in Sarasota?
So, yeah, I came to Sarasota about 2004, I think, for the first time. So a friend of mine married an American girl, and so he came over here. I always remember, you know, I got off the plane here. I felt like I was in a movie. I was so blown away, and I just fell in love with Sarasota. So I've always been visiting.
So how long was it before you, are you here full-time now, or you go back and forth?
No, I go back and forth. I'm just on vacation at the moment, just come over, and I go back and forth, but I like to spend time here, particularly in the winters.
It's
horrendous.
Yeah, right. Yeah, our weather is tough to beat, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your practice back home. What do you do? Who do you help primarily? Has it been more kids now since you found the proclivity for that and you had such a good inroad for that, or are you still pretty broad?
No, I'm broad. I'm open to helping everyone and anyone. So I deal with anything, you know, from fears, phobias, depression, life coaching. I do a bit of everything. So the things I don't keep clients long. You have your hairdresser, you've got clients for life, right?
Right.
So I probably only see people, you know, on average 4 to 6 times. And at that point, but you know, I something happened when I wrote a book called Hello Future, Goodbye Past.
To me.
I sat down and I thought, oh my gosh, there are only 3 areas to mental health. And no one had taught me this. And I realized 3 areas. I thought, the first is, how do you manage your inner dialogue, your self-talk? Number one. The second is, how much trauma have you had? You know, trauma lies dormant. You could be 3 years old. You could be aggressed by a dog and not even remember it, but you'll always be scared of dogs.
Right.
Right? So it sits dormant and it can trigger in different ways. So, you know, fear, and then fear can grip you. So the first was managing your inner dialogue. Second, trauma, dealing with trauma. And the third is the relationship you have with yourself. So I asked a question on assessments, and I'll ask you the question, but you don't have to answer it. The question is, how do you feel about yourself? Do you love, like, dislike, or hate? So people that hate themselves are open to self-harm, suicidal thoughts, suicidal actions. People that love themselves, self-trust, self-acceptance, self-value, self-belief, and self-esteem and self-confidence obviously comes with that. And so if you're scoring high in these areas, well, you wouldn't need to see me. But if you're scoring high in these areas, Eric, you know, you're in good mental shape. And then I discovered that we have different personality types. So different people are more predisposed to different problems. So there's an oral type of personality, and that's someone who is more sensitive, you know, shy and sensitive. Or clearly anxiety can grip people like that.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And they tend to hold things in. And that's the other thing about having good mental health, is not to hold things in. Because if we hold things in, they build up and build up. And then that's how people get depression and other issues. The second type is, these are all Freudian based, by the way, is an anal type. And they're people that, you know, just get angry and blow out and shout and scream, but they recover quickly, you see. So when you get the combination of these two people, you know, the anal type person is recovering and the other one's not. They say, we've hurt my feelings, I can't recover.
Right.
So then there's a third type called hysteria, and they are people who are very flamboyant, very theatrical, you know, cry the drop of hat, you know, recover the drop of hat. So, you know, so when you understand these things, you know the sort of people you should be mixing with. And also when you know those three areas of, I call it the three tiers of mental well-being, you focus on those three areas, working with your personality, you know, anyone can really sort themselves out with a bit of help and a bit of knowledge.
So they say that confidence is one of those things that you're either gaining or losing every day. And I'm sort of a proponent of that one. Do you see something universally or seems to be happening more often than not that causes people to either lose that confidence in themselves or want things that they can do steadfast or routinely that helps them maintain a confidence or build more confidence in themselves so you can have better self-talk and things like that? Or is it really individualized?
Well, you know, everyone's working on their physical health, right? Everyone's dieting, exercising, and everyone knows how important it is to look after your physical health. You know, your mental health is not a given,
right?
You have to look after that too, all right? So confidence comes from experience. You become experienced at something, you become more confident. You get some negativity, your confidence gets knocked. Rejection, for instance, you know? But people need to realize that rejection shouldn't be taken personally. Well, I developed some thinking rules because there are no thinking rules out there. Nobody's told me any. And you've got all these options running around in your head,
right?
Right? No guide. No one's teaching this in school, certainly not in my country. So I developed some thinking rules. And so you work the thinking rules and you develop your confidence by what you tell yourself. So we will believe what we tell ourselves. You know, if you think of imprinting, for instance, well, you know, think about how they imprint or they radicalize people into believing, you know, Islam, the way that's all ingrained into people, into terrorism. Well, so we can imprint ourselves, you know, with positive affirmations, with telling ourselves great things, with learning the thinking rules so we don't take things personally, so we accept things.
What do you think? And I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that's a really big one. I'm super glad you touched on that. What do you think the counterpoint is to not be taking things personally? Because it seems like that is a big issue now. Everybody is always feeling attacked, and there is this strong proclivity to have this personal reaction with something that actually has nothing to do with you. So I'm really curious what your take is on that and how you've helped people not be able to take things so seriously.
Right. Well, you know, it comes down to two things, okay? So the first thing you've got to remember is we all reflect our own behavior. So if someone's running around not liking themselves and they're unhappy, they're going to project hatred, okay? So when someone says something horrible to you, something mean to you, you have to decide whether it's true or not, right? Is it true? Look at the facts, look at the evidence, look at the proof, look at the truth, and decide if it's true. And not because you think it's true, but you have to prove it's true. If you can't prove it's true, then you must let it go. Because otherwise, you know, your mind's going to be run ragged on everything. And if you know it's true, I don't know, if someone said, you know, this shirt doesn't suit you, I would say, why doesn't it suit me? Because I'm looking to find out why. And if they said, well, you know, it's the wrong color for your skin, or I don't know, it doesn't fit you properly, or whatever, I would be like, okay, so now you've just given me an opportunity to self-improve. So the truth is, it's either true or not true. It's either an opportunity to self-improve or that other person is displaying toxic behavior. And then you ignore it because you recognize that they're just projecting that entered onto you. You know, if you're driving down the road and, you know, somebody is angry with you because you indicated the wrong way, so they decide they want to kill you.
Right.
Right. Is that really about you? No. Because if it was me driving the car and I did the same thing, and that person would behave in the same way.
Right.
Right. So, you know, taking things personally is, it's a big, as you say, it's a really big deal. But just to recap, either acknowledge the other person's toxic or use it to your advantage. Simple as that.
How hard do you think it is, or what do you think holds most people back when they're in those types of circumstances and they can't see it as an opportunity to improve? I feel like we're at a point where if you have to say something negative yourself, or you have to look in the mirror and say, hey, I'm not as fit as I could be. Hey, I'm not, you know, as smart as I could be, or whatever the case may be, that we just shy away from that so much now that when we have these opportunities to look at a constructive criticism, for want of a better way of looking at it, as a way to self-improve, we just run from that. What do you think the big hurdle is at this point for that? It seems to be endemic to some degree.
Well, you've got to learn self-love. And it's really important. Without that, you know, you might have problems. And you've got to work on yourself. You know, you can't expect things to happen if you don't make an effort. You have to meet it halfway. So, but if you're working on yourself and you recognize that everyone's got talents, every single person's got gifts. They're just different. And, you know, and nowadays people judge themselves if someone has more than them, or if they're better looking than them, or if they are happier than them. But the truth is, we've got to focus on what we have and our gifts. Because, you know, when I was at school, I used to think I had no talent, no gifts. Because, you know, unless you're the sports captain, or if you're good at sports and, you know, you're good at you get all the girls in school, then these are the kids that you think are ahead. But you've got to remember, life is a marathon, not a sprint.
Really?
You know, and you look back in time. So it's about just working with yourself and not judging yourself against others. I think that's a big problem. You know, it's so easy to do that, but you mustn't try it. I'll try really hard not to do it. So I would use affirmations. One of the things I say to people is use four affirmations. You know, I fear nothing. I fear no one. I can handle any situation. And my best is always good enough. And that's a really important one, because expectation. So you've got to have a realistic expectation. If you're expecting to be as good as someone else at something, then, you know, and you're not, you're going to have a problem. None of us can do better than our best. Agreed?
Agreed.
Right. So that's all you can do. You know, I had someone come to me and said to me, they were an athlete and they wanted to beat the person who was always winning. So I had a 3 minutes race. And I said, well, you've already lost because you're focusing on him.
Mm-hmm.
Why focus on him? You focus on yourself. If you can get your time down by 10 seconds and another 10 seconds and another 10 seconds, now you've got a chance. So the truth is that also, when we look at other people, remember, you know, their public appearance isn't who they are. That's just part of them, right?
Good point.
And then you've got their private appearance and their secret appearance, and which is where all their desires are. So really, we're making too many judgments on face value. It's a problem. You know, people get married because they like, or get into relationships because they like the look of the person, or they take a job because the wage isn't good. But there's always so many more factors, right? So a job, for instance, you know, well, the wages might be great, but, you know, what's the boss like? You know, what are the expectations of the company? They expect you to work 9 o'clock every night, you know? So I think what's really important is to look at things as a whole and not as a part. You know, if we look at things as a part, we get the wrong story. We see the wrong picture. So it's important to look at things as a whole, to focus on yourself, to work on yourself, and actually to focus on others when you don't feel good. You know, a lot of the pleasure I get in life is helping, giving. You know, I help people for free. I try and do things on a daily basis to help others. You know, so if we become too self-obsessed, then that's a problem as well.
And we're living in a world right now where self-obsession is just on tap at all times.
Ooh.
So let me ask you this. I feel that one of the cruxes to this whole thing is kind of balancing your self-love with some kind of self-discipline. Do you have any techniques or thoughts that you've been able to share with people about how you can say to yourself, I'm still a good person, I'm still on track, I'm still worthy in all these things, but I've got X to improve on? How is it that you can accept the truth that isn't maybe so favorable and still love yourself at the same time?
Well, you've got to be kind to yourself, you know, and looking very hard at themselves. And you've got to develop a belief that you deserve good things. So if you do good things, then you can believe you deserve good things, right?
Yeah.
If you're a narcissist, narcissists wouldn't come and see someone like me anyway.
Then they wouldn't know it anyway. That's the beautiful part of it, right. I guess.
but if you develop belief by truth again, don't you?
Right,
truth and facts. And if you're kind to others, then it's easy to believe that you're a kind person.
But when you're in a rut, like when you were having to close down the bakeries and things are going pear-shaped on you, it's easy to be ugly to yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And you think life's not fair. Of course I've gone through that. Who hasn't?
Right.
And life isn't fair. There is injustice, unfortunately. That's just how things are. Right. But you have to work with what you've got. You have to, and you have to get back to this reflection on yourself and just know that, as I said earlier, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And just know that as long as you're going in the right direction, you will get there. You know, you don't see the pain people go through to achieve. We don't see that, the pain an athlete goes through. You know, I'm a soccer fan and we have the Premier League in the UK and people think, oh, they're so lucky. They're making crazy money and they've got such a lucky life. But you know how much pain they go through? They're getting kicked every day. They're having injuries. They're under real pressure. They've got 50,000 people screaming at them if they make a mistake. It's tough, They don't go out on weekends because they're working or playing football. They sacrifice at Christmas. They make a lot of sacrifice from a very young age. So part of, what you need to create success is you have to go through hardship and you have to be strong. And you have to, again, look at the bigger picture and understand why you're doing it. If you think of even physically, your body's a bank. Anything you borrow, you pay back. If you over-exercise, you're going to be sore the next day. Right. Drink too much, you're going to have a thick head.
Right.
But, so it's about really just focusing and seeing the bigger picture and recognizing that, no one can achieve without effort, without suffering, without difficulty. Life is suffering, isn't it, to a degree? The wonderful pleasures in life are moments.
This is true,
right? So, and it's also about letting go of the past. That's a big problem.
And that was a big theme to your book, yes?
Yeah, because, the thing is with the past, we are deleting machines. We're not actually designed to remember everything. I mean, if I said to you, hey, Eric, last Monday, what did you do? Who did you talk to? What time did you get up? What did you eat? What did you watch on television? You probably couldn't answer that.
Right. Not all of this.
Exactly. And that's just a week ago, right?
Right.
So no one can remember things from the past. So what happens is we tend to store traumatic or euphoric things. Even someone on a wedding day, they might remember the vows. But then I suspect very likely that there's people that attended that wedding that they forgot attended or who bought them the gifts.
Exactly.
So we can't rely on our memories. And yet people are basing a lot of today on the past. And then, add those things in we've talked about, taking things personally, and feeling sorry for yourself and looking back at and working from the past on what you're doing today. In other words, if you're basing today on the past, you're probably going to be wrong. So I do, when I do sort of clearance hypnosis to do that, to clear attachment from memory from the past. Because if we've had, you know, a really bad situation, that's how phobias occur.
Right.
You get, you know, you're in a car, wasp comes into the car, freaks you out, you nearly crash, hey, you nearly kill your child or something. That's it. Now you're completely paranoid about wasps. So trauma has a really big effect.
Yeah, and that's one thing I wanted to ask you about when you brought it up earlier. Do you see any cultural or tidal shifts as of the last maybe 5 or 10 years where, I hate to put it this way, where people's traumas have almost become badges, where now our traumas are something that we're almost instinctively relating back to try to deal with the present? Do you see anything where traumas become almost fashionable?
You know, it's interesting because sometimes I have clients and I ask them, I say, have you got anything to lose by letting go of this issue? Because you're absolutely right. Some people use it. You know, it's almost like, I've got anxiety. You know, it's almost used as a label, and they get some sort of empowerment from it.
Right.
Well, they get attention, basically. So, you know, some people feel that, you know, negative attention is good attention. And so some people have things to gain. They play the poor me card. You know, look at me. I've got this problem. I got that problem. So, you know, and I think COVID has exacerbated it.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, COVID, you know, people, it's kind of, I mean, mental health has become much more aware, right? We're all much more aware of it now. But I think during COVID, a lot of people struggled and suffered. And now they carry it around today. There isn't a day goes by when people don't mention COVID to me. And I've noticed that here a lot too,
right?
You know, during COVID, we had this issue. You know, children now, they ought to be homeschooled. There's a lot of, it's created a lot of change in society, you know, because it was, there was a lot of fear around, wasn't it? But the fear-mongering, you know, people were scared, you know. But again, it's related to the past. And I think lack of social interaction during COVID was a big thing, particularly in the UK, because, you know, people weren't allowed to go out. People weren't allowed to interact with other people. So if you were, you know, on your own or you're a child without siblings, it could be very, very tough. But hopefully, you know, what I'd like to see is I'd like to see more mental health education in schools. You know, that's why my app's here. My app's here to help teenagers, because adolescence is tough.
Yes.
See, that's when your problems creep in. Virtually everyone who has adult issues, you know, would have had some type of issue in their adolescence. And really, that's what my goal is here, is to help others, make it affordable to them. It's a low-cost subscription-based app. Make it affordable to them so that you can save them from future trauma. Because when you had trauma young, you're more likely to get it again.
Yeah, the cycle tends to repeat itself.
It's triggered.
So talk to me a little bit about the app then. What was the impetus for this? And do you want to see it be implemented in schools or just school-aged kids be able to have the access to it?
I think teenagers are reluctant to share their feelings with their parents.
So
I think teenagers are reluctant to share, you know, their issues with others. And so a lot of people are dealing with a lot of problems. You know, they have identity, transition identity problems, you know, in their teenage years. They have, you know, spots, and they have, so their body issues. You know, there's a massive transformation going on. There's peer pressure. Nowadays, of course, we've got cyberbullying.
Right.
You know, we've got, you know, social medias. I think it's made mental health worse.
Yeah.
In many respects, I think that's an issue. And so my app is designed to help people get through it. So in the app, I have an advice line, actually, where they can ask me a question in confidence and receive a response within 24 hours, or my best, within 24 hours.
Brilliant.
I have a learning center where I have the mental fitness program and lots of other learnings. So it's teaching people, it's advising people. I have a rescue center for quick fixes for things like panic attacks. People have a lot of panic attacks.
Yes. It's
frightening. You know, I've had them in the past. People have anxiety, other types of anxiety attacks. People are courage boosting for, so I have lots of quick fixes. They're like 1.5 minute videos. It's all animated. So I'm a character, Mr. Ivan. And Mr. Ivan is someone who teaches all these things. So he's a teacher, mental health teacher. So we have the rescue videos. We have the learning center. I have hypnosis audios for things like cyberbullying, things like sports performance, fear of exams, and lots of different audios. I have the advice center, as I said. I have a podcast within there. I do a podcast called the Teen Talk Pod with Mr. Ivan. I have an assessment center for the parents. So each 30 days, they fill in the form and it tells the parent how they're doing, if there's any issues that they need to manage. So it's a support app. It's a teaching app. And it's a crux for them. And it's always, or should I say, is as well as it's a like an insurance policy for the parent, right? Because, you know, suicide is on the up with youngsters.
You're right.
And people are hiding their feelings. Peer pressure is causing that too, or fear of being different. So it encompasses a bit of everything.
Mm. Those types of things have always kind of existed, society or culturally, the pressure on teenagers in those times. Do you think there are certain things, maybe beyond the aftermath of COVID, that have exacerbated those things in our recent past here?
Well, the media, they specialize in frightening people. That's what they do, right? They don't want a story that says, oh, so-and-so went down the road, had a wonderful day. They're not going to say that, are they?
Yeah.
He went down the road and someone jumped out on him and he didn't know what to do. So the media, and that means social media too, and just created much more awareness about things. There's much more drama, isn't there, now?
Right.
And drama causes fear. You know, so of course now we've got generations of youngsters who are not going out to play. You know, when I was a child, I was playing football. I was climbing trees. So, you know, the children now, they're staying indoors. They're playing games. The parents are terrified to let them out. So they're not being conditioned. So that I think generally they're a much softer breed of people. And so they're much more fear orientated. And they're much less able to take risk.
Yeah, risk aversion is bad.
Big. Yeah.
But As far as the negativity of the news and things like that goes, I guess that's sort of always been the case. It just seems, I wonder if you've got an opinion as to why it seems that we're taking the ball and running with it into our personal lives so much now.
We're just influenced, aren't we, by media, by television, by drama. I mean, people like to watch horror films.
I don't either.
But why do people like that? And they like to ride a roller coaster. Right. So there's an element of people like a little bit, but then of course it can become very traumatic. I mean, you know, I used to have people come to see me because they wouldn't go in the ocean because they'd watch Jaws. Right? And now people are scared of clowns because of, I think it's Chucky movies or some type of movie, you know. So people become very traumatized by negativity, but they don't ignore it.
Right.
I still get reeled into it. I say to a lot of people, you know, if the news is scaring you, don't watch the news. If, you know, don't listen to the news. If social media is causing you problems, don't go on social media. But people still, you know, dip their toe in, don't they? They still go into it and then they create some fear. So movies can traumatize people, you know, situations, stories. And so if people aren't as robust today, then the fears and the traumas are becoming stronger. And people don't know what to do.
Do you think that reality is objective proof that we are becoming softer, for want of a better way of putting it?
I think so. Absolutely. I think, you know, people are more modicum. you know, people are more protected. You know, as I said, people are not, you know, where's it going?
Right, that's
people are just in, you know, these kids are interacting with others only online.
Exactly.
They're not having any face-to-face, you know, and so COVID, that happened then, and I think it's continued. So, you know, what's the answer?
That's what I was just going to say. Okay, so I think it probably goes without saying that the toothpaste doesn't get put back in the tube. Yeah. So you mentioned havening and some of the other practices that you've become educated in and been able to help people with. I'm wondering if you can expand on maybe TFT or some of those other things that kind of take everything one step beyond this little surface world we live in and react to all the time.
So, you know, havening and thoughtful therapy, you know, that's the tapping therapy. You know, these things are to clear trauma. So there's some rules, okay? So, you know, if you're traumatized by something, you need some help to have it cleared. You need to, you know, for instance, you need to outlet your feelings. So if you were to do havening, which is rubbing from your shoulders to elbow, talk out your feelings. Offload them, you know, process them. So PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, what happens is something happens that's become very traumatized to you and you don't process it. So when we're sleeping, our eyes are bobbling around, they're processing all of our thoughts. Mm-hmm. So when they're traumatized, it doesn't happen. So at the end of a havening session, I would have people move their eyes left to right 8 to 10 times. That's a manual process. You know, it's not, unless you've got psychosis, that's very different, right? Because psychosis requires medication.
Right.
I don't know why people continue to live with these issues when there's something there to fix. There is always something to do that they can do. There isn't anyone that can't fix themselves with some help.
How hard is it to tenant that stance?
What do you mean?
That anyone can help themselves.
Well, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, you know, and I think a lot of it is about them recognizing that there is a way of doing it. I mean, look, it's a very, very simple cognitive rule, and it's the circle. And if you think of a circle, and inside the circle, you write everything I can control, and then outside the circle, you write everything that I can't control. And now everything that happens to you in life, every situation that you have, is either in the circle or out the circle, right? If it's out the circle, you're powerless to it.
This is classic stoicism.
Yeah. And it's really simple. And if it's out the circle, you're powerless to it, you have to let it go. And if it's in the circle and you can manage it, then you can manage it. So then it's a question of how can we manage it, right? We know that mental health can be managed. We know that a lot of physical health can be managed. Go and see a doctor. If you have a bad stomach, you go and see a doctor. It doesn't go away. So I think a lot of it comes down to people not looking and people not realizing that you can resolve these issues. You know, it's a bit like hypnotherapy, okay? So a lot of people are frightened of it. You know, they think that, you know, I could just put people in
and meekness
while he's barking like a dog.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, those people want to do it. Those people, these things are set, you know, there's some ways of getting people into hypnosis before they go onto the stage, and they're game for it. You know, it's not like they can go up to anyone, or they've seen a movie where someone's hypnotized to do something evil or bad, but this is not true. The mind will not do anything it doesn't want to do in any state or condition. You know, we're born to survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would do anything. I mean, that chap, you know, that went climbing, chopped his arm off in the...
Oh, yeah.
Grand Canyon, wasn't it?
Yep.
I mean, that's how powerful, you know, we're designed, you know, for survival. I mean, everyone would still, if they had nothing. Everyone, if you were faced with, you know, you yourself or someone you love being killed, you sort of do anything you can to protect yourself and to protect your family. It's inherent in us, you know. But, you know, also life has changed a lot. You know, years ago, people had nothing.
people lived a harder life. So we're actually living in the best phase of history right now.
Right.
You know? And so I think that...
By some measure, even.
Absolutely. You know, 100 years ago, no one could clean up a warm shower.
Right.
Right? So today, we live in a really good, safe environment. I think people need to recognize that more. And we know what things are dangerous and things we shouldn't do. Again, that's born into us, isn't it? You know, because it's just about, you know, having balance, I think, creating a balance in yourself and in your life. But of course, your upbringing is very important.
Yeah.
Right. So if you have critical parenting role, in other words, your parents saying to you, so one of the big problems with anxiety is it's like a program being installed. When your mother or father keeps saying to you, be careful, you're going to hurt yourself. Don't do that. You can drop it. You know, you fall. What do you do? Think about what's happening there, right?
Right.
You know, oh no, you mustn't ride your bike like that. You're going to hurt yourself again. And then they fall off their bike and they're all pulled. And so it's kind of a breeding ground for anxiety. But if you say to them, you know, you can do this. Well done. Congratulations. You can do this. Not to the point where they can't do it, of course.
Yeah.
There's a level of everything. So, you know, if you say these things, you know, you teach nurturing parenting, children grow up more robust, more secure. So, you know, security. So anxiety is environmental. It's genetical. And it's learned behavior. It's just, you know, so maybe the parents are educating about how, you know, how we develop our children so that they're not so anxious.
Right. And that's actually what I was just going to ask. I guess it's the old adage of give them roots and give them wings.
Mm.
But now it's, as you mentioned, you can't send your kid outside to play. You can't do these things. So what's kind of the way to empower people, empower the youth, the teenagers like this, to be confident to do these things and go out in the world without helicopter parenting them, for want of a better way to put it?
Well, I mean, that's why I've got a book coming out to try and change
so that. Yeah.
I mean, really, that needs to be taught young. You know, it needs to be, you know, I think school could do a lot more. You know, I was watching the show about altruism, and they were trying to discover whether or not us human beings are inherently bad people. So they, I think Harvard and someone in Germany started doing tests on the children. So they would drop something on the floor and pretend that they couldn't reach it, and to see whether the child would help them. So the child helps them, picks it up and gives it to them. Then they would have like goody and baddie with puppets, you know? And they realized that actually we're actually nice people. It's just that life changes us, right? So I have a daily meditation in the podcast, you know, where you practice self-love and loving others. And that changes people's behavior. There was, in the same show that I saw, they were doing that. And there was gang members that were no longer becoming gang members because, you know, otherwise it gets replaced with hatred, right? You know, if you have a difficult life, a lot of hardship, you develop a hatred and anger. Self-anger will be anger on other people. So again, getting back to that daily meditation, just 10 minutes a day, just practicing loving yourself and loving others changes your whole outlook on everything, you know? And I think that there's a lot more can be done.
Agreed. You mentioned meditation a couple of times, and I want to ask you, I'm just going to go ahead and assume you the importance of it.
Yeah.
Can you give me some advice, or people watching the show, some advice about how to develop a meditation ritual? Because it seems to be that the cake and the slinky for most people is, oh, I tried it once and I couldn't, or I tried it once and my brain wouldn't be quiet and meditation just isn't for me. But given its importance, what do you think an easier door is for people to get in?
So meditation is a practice. What does word practice mean? It's effort, right? You're not going to just be good at it on day one. In fact, I meditate and I often fall asleep you know, for a few minutes. It's just because that's why people either believe that's why you sit cross-legged and up straight, because otherwise, if you lay down, meditation, hypnosis, trance, prayers, it's all got symmetry, all of it. So it's really just about being with yourself. Truth is, we're all alone. You know, people are like, oh, I don't want to be on my own. But we are. We're all alone. You know, we're born apart, we die alone. We share our lives with other people. And so meditation is a development of accepting or understanding or being comfortable with being on your own. It's really important. So I've noticed that some people get meditation in different ways. Some people have it walking in nature, faith, which is reflection.
Right.
Some people have meditation jogging. You know, so different people can get a form of meditation in different ways. It's really thinking time. But the meditation, you know, where you sit still, is, as I said, it's a practice. You have to work at it. And you can do different things. So you could practice self-love. You could practice gratitude. That's another big thing.
Talk to me about the importance of that.
It's everything. If you can't appreciate things, you're not going to be happy. Again, we're projecting what we're reflecting. You know, if you get the young man's walking down the street, he's swaggering his shirt, right? He's acting the tough guy. He's projecting aggression. What's he going to attract? You know, the Buddhist monk walking down the street, you know, sending out love and kindness, what's he attracting? So with meditation, so the more you meditate, the more you can have gratitude and thankfulness, the happier you feel because you're projecting it. And, you know, and it's so easy nowadays for people not to appreciate anything.
Right.
And it's a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's one of those things, and I don't normally interject myself personally, but it is one of those things that I've noticed so much. And this year I declared 2024 the year of extreme gratitude.
Yes.
And I've been riding it completely. And that's why I had to say, talk to me a little bit about that, because I have personally noticed changes, and people that understand this much better than me can talk about the physiological changes that can result and the neurological changes that can result from practicing gratitude. So I thought that was pretty powerful.
Absolutely. And I'm very grateful to be here today.
You know, same, grateful to have you, see?
And, you know, when you're grateful, what feelings you get? You get happiness,
right?
When you're ungrateful, you know, to spoil is to ruin. And this is another interesting aspect to parenting. People try and give their children everything.
That's the instinct.
But actually, they're not. They're actually setting them up for a fall. You know, if they're, I'm not saying it should be horrible to children, but
right.
You've got to be balanced, you know. Any extremity, you know, if you neglect a child, you're going to have a problematic child, right? Because, you know, people have big problems as adults and had problematic childhoods. But if you neglect, that's wrong. And if you spoil, that can cause as many problems, if not more. And of course, that can also breed narcissism also.
Right.
So it's about a balance, isn't it? It's about a balance. You know, if you can teach your children gratitude, if you or people gratitude, you know, and again, just this appreciating what you've got. I mean, I walk down the street, you know, and I'm so grateful that I can walk. Same, right? I've had situations where I can't walk. You know, I have broke my ankle before. You know, I'm grateful, you know, for whatever it is. And so when a child's spoiled and they're not appreciating anything, nothing can make them happy.
Right.
And I believe that this is part of the issue, you know, with drugs, with movie stars and things. You think about it, they've everything too young. All the successes and trappings, where do they go from there? Because we're all looking for more. And life is a journey, right? Mm-hmm. So if we have everything young, where's the journey going? So it doesn't pay to have everything, especially too young, you know, because that's why people go off the rails. So, you know, you want to, people retire. When you retire, that's the time when you want to have, you know, mortgage-free property, right? It's when you want to have time for yourself and enjoy your grandchildren if you have them, mm-hmm. and enjoy your life. You know, you can't have that at 30, you know, because
right.
You won't be fulfilled because we also need a level of fulfillment. You know, it's like, well, your show, for instance, you know, the first time you did it, you had no subscribers and you build it up,
right?
And then you get to the point where you have X amount of subscribers and now you're appreciating it and now you're growing it. Everything grows, doesn't it? We grow up, plants grow, trees grow, you know, and that's the essence of life, and it's appreciating that.
Right.
Not wanting everything now.
Maybe that's a good slogan. It doesn't pay to have everything.
No.
I don't know that that occurs to a lot of people.
No, it doesn't, because it's, you know, it's not going to give me the satisfaction. You know, I wanted to create a t-shirt. I wanted to create some t-shirts with some mental health slogans.
I think you should.
And one of them was going to be, sow whatever it is you want to reap. Right? It's not reap what you sow. Oh, it's true, but sow what you want to reap. In other words, you know, work towards it.
Right.
Enjoy the journey. The other thing that I've noticed is that, you know, a lot of people are just wanting the future now. They're rushing towards the future.
And that's anxiety super fuel.
Right. You can't do that. You know, this isn't Star Trek, is it?
Right.
You know, you've got to remember that we never move. The future's coming to us and the past is going backwards.
That's an interesting way to couch it.
We don't move. Right? So we have to be in the present moment or we're going to be unhappy. Meditation grounds you for present moment. Another thing it does. So it creates your gratuity, self-love, love of others, and being in the present moment. And these are the things that are super important for inner peace, because that's what we're striving for, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, that's ultimately what we mean when you have good mental health. We're really talking about inner peace.
Yeah. So having a lot of one thing and not another won't do that. You hear many stories about many rich people that are miserable.
You're right.
You know, I have clients, you know, in that situation. You know, it's a balance. You have to have a little bit of everything. And if you're growing and moving forward, you get more of it, don't you? You know, if you, unless just for argument's sake, you've got 1,000 subscribers and then you get 1,100, you're moving forward, you're happier, you're progressing. So that's where the happiness comes from.
Everything counts in large amounts.
Absolutely. You know, you need a little bit of, you know, obviously health as well. I think that's one of the most underestimated things too.
Agreed.
You know, and it's something we don't really appreciate till we're a bit older, but we should be taught to appreciate that younger. You know, it's very hard to relate to someone who is disabled perhaps when you're younger, isn't it? As you get older, well, you know, we do. So you need good health. You need good people around you. You need good levels of self-esteem. And you need to be working towards something, you know?
Right.
You get so much more pleasure.
Pursuit of the goal.
Absolutely.
That's your attachment to the good.
Well, you know, I saw something. It's true. You know, we're climbing mountains. And when we get to the top of the mountain, we're at the bottom of the next.
Yes.
So we're always doing this. And that's the process of life. You know, and you know, it's like, you know, somebody has an ambition to achieve something. I don't know. Someone's a musician, for instance, and their goal is to have a record in the charts.
Yeah.
Well, what happens when they do that? They put another one, don't they?
Right.
And another one. So that's not going anywhere. Same for all of us. You know, we repeat every day. The thoughts that you have today, the worries that you have today, you had them yesterday. And then you get them back in tomorrow. So everything's just a process. One step, one step, one step. And that's why if you don't get pleasure in what you're doing today, you won't get it tomorrow. You can't, can you?
Invariably not, I suppose. Oh, I hadn't thought of it that way.
No. If you're having a really hard time, you've got to remember that the sun always comes back out. Everything's temporary, right? Everything's impermanent. Everything.
That's an interesting point to make, and I certainly ascribe to that one as well. But do you say that in the frame of everything's temporary as in we'll be dead someday? Or do you say that in everything temporary as in we'll live through this?
Both. But I think it's to understand that you'll get through it. And the obviously unfortunate thing in life, one of the difficult things in life to accept is that, you know, we don't get much gain from success, actually. We get learning from failure.
Right.
You know? And so we have to somehow try and embrace failure. But while we're going through the difficulty, we have to understand why, you know, what it is we want. You know, because if we don't, we have to live in acceptance. I think that's where it's at. You have to accept everything that's happened to your life. You have to accept the cards you were dealt and you're born. You know what? But a good poker player can, a good card player can shuffle those cards and deal themselves a new hand, right? And that's how I see it. And you work with the tools that you have. And if you can do that, again, you know, you're promoting more happiness within. You can, we can all sit and whinge about what we don't have. There isn't
an old billionaire out there that wouldn't give everything away to be young again, right?
Right. You know, everyone, if you have poor health, you know, people would give anything for good health.
That's right.
And, you know, it's just how life is. But, you know, whatever's happened to you in the past, you have to accept it.
So this is kind of the amor fati principle, the stoicism, amor fati, we love whatever happens to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the rules that I have, the rules I have are the circle, the work everything with facts, evidence, truth, and proof. So you're making good decisions. You know, one of the things I've noticed, and this is one of the issues with youngsters and a lot of other people too, but you know, I noticed that we're too emotional. You need to be more logical.
Do you mean too emotional as in hyperbolic or just too many emotions?
Emotional as in, you know, knee-jerk react, emotional behavior. This is one of the real things I've noticed about mental health in general. And of course, teenagers have a lot of emotion.
Right. And hyperbolic by nature.
Absolutely. We all have a lot of emotion, right? Of course. But if we can make our decisions based on logic, based on facts, truths, and evidence, what you can prove to be true, we make better decisions. You know, most people that have lots of problems in their life, right? People living in drama, they're living on fine ends, you know, high levels of emotion,
right?
Causes them a lot of problems. So one of the things I try to do is to teach people to, it's one of the things about the app, you know, is to regulate their emotions and to have them making better decisions and, you know, they'll have a better life.
How do you get people to understand when is appropriate to divorce your emotions from your decision-making process and when is appropriate to consider your emotions in your decision-making process?
Well, I think you've got to, again, you've got to look at it as a whole. You've got to think about your emotions. You know, let's say someone wants to lose weight, right? And so they're emotionally eating and they really want to lose weight, but they can't stop eating. Well, they're a bit emotional about it, you know, and so there's often a bit more to the situation. But, you know, you've got to look at both sides. You've got to be logical. You've got to think, okay, well, if I eat that cake, I'm not going to lose weight. That's a fact.
Facts, yeah, exactly.
If I truly want to lose weight, then I mustn't eat that cake. My emotions, I have emotions I want to do every day, but I don't allow myself because I look at the bigger picture. I look at it logically, you know, and I keep my goals. It's very hard for humans to do something that they don't get an instant gain,
right?
You know, if you diet for one day, it's not going to make any difference.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? You diet for a week, maybe a little bit. But if, you know, somebody, it's like, I've seen this 100 times. Someone comes to me and says, I need to lose weight. So a woman wants to lose weight. She's getting married or she's going to a wedding. She wants to fit into a dress, but she wants to lose 20 pounds, right? So she's got something really to aim on. And then what happens is she loses 20 pounds and then 6 months later, she's gained 20 pounds. So for me, that means that we mustn't look at everything as like bus stops. I'm sorry, as destinations. We have to look at things like bus stops, sub-destinations.
Yeah.
Mountain, next one.
Right.
If we can get that mindset, that's logical thinking, isn't it?
Yes.
The logic is, you know, you don't lose 20 pounds. You want to consistently get to a point where you've lost the amount of weight and then maintain it. So we need to look a bit further ahead. You know, it's very hard when we don't get quick gains. You know, they did that experiment in the school where they gave the children all a sweet each, this candy each, and said, you can have this candy now, but if you save it, you can have two tomorrow. And the ones that saved it had two tomorrow, more logical, obviously, had a better outcome in life. And so, you know, short-term pain is long-term gain.
Right.
And short-term gain is long-term pain the other way around, you know. So,
yeah. So is this is the
emotion. That's a perfect example, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that gets to be a fine line or a grand chasm to navigate, depending on who you are, I suppose.
Yeah.
This is the easy decisions, hard life, hard decisions, easy life.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes discipline, doesn't it?
Right.
We have to learn discipline, you know. So, logical thinking is trained. You can be trained.
But you have to, at some point, put your emotions aside to do that. Yes?
I think you just got to, you know, you've got to look at both sides of the coin, you know. The thing is that if I got a coin now and I flicked a coin and I said heads or tails and you said heads, okay, and you got it right, I could flick that 10 times and then say heads or tails. And somebody may say tails because it's been heads 10 times. Well, averages.
Totally flawed logic.
Flawed logic. The truth is every single spin has a different outcome. It's a different entity, you know.
Completely independent of the one before. Yeah. This is the guise of the roulette wheel.
Yeah, absolutely, you know. The other thing is that we all suffer from something called illusory correlation. It's quite a big word.
Yes.
It's a correlation. You heard that word?
Yes, most definitely. I would love to hear your...
Gamblers, for instance, they could lose their home. They could lose their job. They could lose their savings. Give them $50 and they go and gamble because they believe they can win. So when we get something right... We think we're going to get it right again, naturally. You predict the winner of X Factor or Britain's Got or America's Got Talent, and you think you'll get it right again next time. And so consequently, we've got this illusory correlation. You know, in the UK, bookmakers make hundreds of millions of pounds profit from people that think they can guess the football results.
Exactly.
Who's going to win a horse race or something. It's the same principle. But the truth is, it's like the spin in the coin. It's not true. You may get something right. You may not. You know, and if you do, great. But we mustn't illude ourselves that we're right about everything because we're not. It's emotional thinking.
Right.
So it's back to the same scenario. But if you look at the facts, again, the evidence, truth, and proof, you'll realize that that's not accurate. You can't. But no one knows what's going to happen in the future.
Right. I was going to say, unless you're a determinist, you have to accept that the probability is somewhat static.
Yeah. You can make calculated prediction. Of course you can, right? And people do. You know, that's algorithm. You know, people in insurance companies do every day, don't they?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and clearly that's a safer way of doing it. But they're still based on logic. If you think about, do you think that the military make emotional decisions, the hospitals, the schools, the colleges, any business
clearly can't.
What would happen if they did? They go bust. Well, every business would go bust if they made emotional decisions. So, but people can do that in business, but struggle with that in their personal life. That's how it is. So it's just really recognizing the truth and recognizing that every situation requires, you know, a logical aspect to it. So that you don't make as many mistakes.
Yeah, this because we're defined by the choices ultimately.
Absolutely, we are.
Well, I feel like we could have two or three episodes. I've got a lot I'd like to talk to you about or ask more about, rather, I should say. But let's get you out of here on maybe something fun or maybe something a little bit more global, as it were.
All right.
It seems to be that a big theme, regardless of the therapies you're employing or the disciplines you're trying to get people to recognize and employ in themselves, kind of has the cotter pin of this big picture view, this 30,000 foot view or whatever. Is there one thing or a handful of things or something you could share that you think helps people to be able to do that, especially when the circumstances getting you or tricking you or coaxing you into focusing on the minutia and making that trap decision, as it were?
I think it's about learning. I think it's about reaching out for help when you need it. And it's about education. You know, I think we all need to, we're not going to be able to do anything if we haven't learned to do it.
Right.
You know, and I think it's just super important to be, to learn to trust yourself, trust your subconscious, trust yourself, listen to your intuition, but at the same time, balance the logic.
That's powerful.
Right. Yeah. Because again, if you just go on intuition, then you can be right, but wrong. So it's also about developing your senses. You know, people are either visual, they're audio, then they're kinesthetic, which is feeling. And if you are visual, then you'll make everything based on visual things. So I think that people could really benefit from trying to develop other senses.
Valuable.
So again, some more of a rounder picture, you know. And if people do have problems, you'll get help. It's out there. You know, there are people out there
that can help,
you know? I think so. Rather than just go to the doctors and get some medication, carry on with life. Do you think that fixes anything? Of course not.
That's just a different brand of slab.
Absolutely. It's a whole new conversation, isn't it? But all that's going to happen is that you're going to end up, you know, with side effects, with masking the issue, not dealing with the issue. You know, people get so heavily medicated that they're like zombies. You know, it affects their mindset, affects their ability to think quickly. And, you know, and as I said, just working with the tools you've got.
Right. Amen to that too.
You know, not being too risk adverse, not being too risky. And remember this, but your anxiety is good for you. You need it. Think about if it didn't have any. I know a couple of people that didn't have anxiety and they both been killed on motorcycles. Is that unfair? So we need a little bit. So let's not make anxiety such a bad word.
Right?
Right? It's just if you have too much anxiety, it's a problem. If you have just about enough, you know, it keeps you safe.
Valuable insight.
It keeps you things cautious. You know, otherwise you end up in a terrible problem. And there's one thing I also would like to say, you know, this distinction between mental health and mental illness is very mixed, but there is a clear distinction. And people are really shy and embarrassed to a lot of people, particularly in the UK, to admit they've got mental health issues because they feel like they're telling everyone they're crazy. And it's not true. You know, some aside got psychosis. And I've often tried to find a new word for that. So I invented a word called criticoling. It's in the Urban Dictionary. And it means people that try to control you through criticism. You know, you're useless at that. You know, this type of thing. But I'd love to find a new word for mental health. Mental well-being I use.
Yeah.
Like that. Strapline is sideways, mental well-being. So, you know, but it's important to know that everyone has a struggle. And anyone that tells you that they don't, you know, unless they're a narcissist or there's something else wrong.
Yeah, right. Because
we all have problems. But, you know, let's embrace anxiety and control it.
Right? I love that.
That's it. Let's work with it. That's what we have. That's part of our genetic makeup. So why can't we work with it?
I love that. We can. We can.
We absolutely can. Realize it's there to protect us. To help us, to guide us.
Not control us.
No. And then again, learning the boundaries of the control, you know? And, you know, your heart race a little bit. It's great. It's a great thing.
Keep moving.
You know, when you see people on TV and perhaps, I don't know, Strictly Come Dancing,
for instance,
and in the rehearsals they mess up or live singers, you know, and you'll know this, they very rarely make that many mistakes when they're live.
Right.
Why? Because the anxiety is helping them. It's making them really perform. It's keeping their focus. It's really, you know, engaging because something else takes you over, doesn't it?
It does. The lights out and we're on.
Exactly. So that's what anxiety does for you. So it can be a great thing.
That's really valuable advice.
Yeah.
Well, Ivan, I'm so grateful that you came down. I'm going to stick to the gratitude theme.
Sure.
I really appreciate everything you share. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are going to get value from what you share. Definitely going to link to your books and your apps. Absolutely. And should the opportunity present itself again, we'd love to have you back.
That'd be amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.